Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed puts it all on the table, but confuses markets. Tech takes another leg down, chalking up 3 weeks of pain, but small caps charge on with a great week. And our guest today, renowned trader Linda Rashke, is on with us. All this and much more on episode number 680 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to another week of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. I'm also the founder of Horowitz & Company. We're an investment advisory firm, and yes, we do this all the time. So it is not theory that we're talking about. We're talking about exactly what is going on, what we're researching, how we're doing it. So it gives you some good insight and education. Happy New Year to all of those celebrating Rosh Hashanah. May you have a sweet year, one filled with good health, one filled with happiness, and I guess we have to say prosperity as we're doing the Disciplined Investor Podcast here. Hey, a quick note I want to mention to you, great news. You can now listen to the Disciplined Investor Podcast on Amazon Music. They just launched their brand new podcast component of their app and online. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, I guess, I don't know if you can, I'm not quite sure if you can get this if you're not a Prime member. But then again, who's not a Prime member, right? So you can go over to Amazon, your new app, and on the top, I think when you press search, it brings up podcast right away. Click in the Disciplined Investor, and there you got it. You're listening from any device. Maybe even try your Alexa and say, hey, Alexa, I want to listen to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Let's see. Actually, somebody do that for me. See if that happens. You know me. I won't have Alexa on. I won't have anything listening to what I'm doing. I try to keep that separate from my life. All right, so, you know, we've been talking about the Fed. We've been talking about the Fed a lot. And the reason for that is that, well, I mean, they've been the main driver for the markets in terms of liquidity and assisting on the risk on sentiment trade. That whole idea that there's plenty of liquidity. And, you know, if anything happens that's really bad, let's say in the credit markets, well, the Fed's going to be there to clean it up. Or when we look at some of the areas of the interest rate environment for real estate, well, the Fed's going to drop and keep interest rates really low for a long period of time. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time discussing this today, but I want to mention one point. And that was that the Fed had their meeting on Wednesday, and it seemed that it wasn't as well-received as other times. I mean, yes, once the Fed changed their pitch on how long they're going to have the zero interest rate environment, the ZIRP, markets kind of moved up very nicely, but quickly there was a reassessment of this, and that turned into another sell program that we saw for the end of the week. So maybe what happened was this. That originally there was this whole idea that there was going to be a zero interest rate bound on the markets and involved with the Fed's decision-making process through 2021. And now that they push this back a little bit, now that they move this to 2023, yes, 2023, we are now going to have zero interest rates, or the 0 to 2.25%. Maybe this was a moment that the market said, wait, what? Are you kidding? I thought we were going to be finished with this whole thing and we were going to have this recovery that was going to be V-shaped, and we were all planning on that, investing in that, putting our money to work with that as the backdrop. And maybe now what the reassessment is, that if the Fed doesn't think that we are going to be able to see a resolution until 2023 and a recovery, maybe I need to rethink my positioning. Maybe it's going to be a lot longer that they're talking about. And while I appreciate the fact they're going to have low interest rates and I appreciate the fact they're going to have all of the tools at their disposal, whether it's quantitative easing, whether it's, you know, some of these Main Street lending programs, which, by the way, had a terrible pickup, terrible pickup on the Main Street lending program. A lot of banks don't want to do it. I think it was 2% of the total that was allocated for the Main Street lending program was used. I think that's the number. But people are now blaming the market sell-off on this comment that the Fed didn't do more. I don't know how much more they could do. They laid it all on the table. So I'm not quite sure what else they could have done. But that's what they're saying is to blame for the market sell-off, particularly in the tech and in that sector. But if you really get back to it, put the Fed aside, because this sell-off started happening after that blow-off top we saw a few weeks back where that whale came in. Remember, we talked about SoftBank, which was the identified whale, where they came in and started buying call options on some of the mega caps. And they artificially inflated the markets because the opposite side of the trade had to be to cover those and hedge out that risk and buy. So you had the FANG names that were just going up dramatically on those couple of days until the aha moment came where everybody said, what is actually going on here? And we got down to the bottom of this and all the investigation work was done. Found out that, oh man, it really wasn't fundamentally anything different. It wasn't anything significant. All it was this trade that was being done in the billions of dollars. So if we're blaming the Fed for this, which just happened on Wednesday, and we see actually a few weeks ago is when we started to see that this trade started unraveling in the large caps, in the large cap mega tech tech sector area, I don't think we can necessarily blame it on the Fed. It's convenient to think that, but I don't think that's true. I think there's actually a better explanation all this and what's going on right now. Now, of course, we could blend in a lot of things, but one of the things that we are seeing is that there's excess supply that's coming in. We've seen all the SPACs, you know, the special purpose acquisition companies really pour in. I mean, there's a lot of them coming to the market. These blank check companies, these blind pools. We've also seen a massive amount of IPOs that potentially could have had and could have the opportunity to draw money out of some of the names that have been performing so well through the year. And in particular, we saw last week, right? One of the biggest tech IPOs of all time, Snowflake. Snowflake definitely could have been one of those names that drew money out of other names in the tech area. We also saw iFrog, we saw Amwell, we saw Unity Software just last week, and that was the big names of interest. There were several others that actually came out and SPACs that were priced and came to market as well. And if, in fact, there is this move towards SPACs and money's just pouring in to those, then that leaves a little bit of a gap in what money can be invested in some of these very stretched valuation names. And maybe investors are saying, you know what? There seems to be a great opportunity in these IPOs for the future. The newer names that are out there, fresh money in. Maybe I don't want to commit more money to these names that are finding nosebleed level of valuations. And let me look for other opportunities and alternatives. And in addition to that, think about this. There's probably been a lot of fund managers, it definitely has been, that had to dump some of their positions in these names. You know, again, I'm not going to mention them all, but the Amazons and the Apples and the Netflix, all these names that ran up and became over-concentrated in their portfolios, right? Think about that. There's only a certain amount of maximum position that they could own in some of their portfolios before they have to scale it back. But at the same time, they still have to do something with that money. They have to invest in something. They have to stay within their charter. They have to put the money to work. Maybe some of it could stay in cash for a while, but what they do is they look for opportunities maybe that have better valuations in some sectors in the markets that maybe haven't seen that run-up. And they reposition. So what we saw, for example, last week was this great IPO run. And maybe what we're seeing is last week also growth dramatically underperforming the value, even though banks aren't doing that hot and energy's not doing great. And why would you want to invest in these terrible areas? So I think that we do have this risk-on appetite, right? This risk-on environment. But as new supply is hitting the markets, some money's going to be drawn out of what's working, especially into the end of the year, as oftentimes you do see the potential for a reversion to the mean trade that happens. And if we see what happened after the Fed talked about this new elongated period of time that they're going to keep their zero interest rates, and the fact that on that the yield curve started to steepen because we have inflation that is really being pushed into expectations right now. So on one hand, the Fed is saying that they don't see inflation, they're using inflation averaging. On the other hand, the markets are like, it looks like we're going to see inflation. And where is that not good for? What areas of the markets are those going to be problematic for? And what area of the markets are going to see some benefit? And if that's the playbook, if we are starting to see more of a inflationary environment, maybe we do start to see a change in the complexion of those investment sectors that are doing well, maybe from a move from growth to value. I mean, look at the differential this year. The Russell 1000 large cap is up, I think, close to about 19% this year, while the 1000 value is down 12%. That's more than a 30% spread this year, just this year. So banks haven't been doing well. Financials have been a big part of this as well. Energy shares not doing well. So one of the things that we may see, and we again saw it last week pretty clearly with a very significant, and actually over the last couple of weeks, we saw this kind of move away from what was working into what hasn't been working. Something to keep a watch on. Now, another thing that's probably spooking markets, weighing on sentiment, is this potential for new lockdowns. Now, whether or not you agree with the lockdowns or not, not the point here. Not whether I agree with them or not, not the point. The fact of the matter is we just saw that Israel put a 3-week lockdown nationwide on their economy, on everything. It's like, you know, essential workers, of course, can go to work, etc. But right back to where they were a few months back. We're not talking about it here, but in Israel, there's a three-week lockdown, and Britain is now considering another nationwide lockdown as their cases rise. And there's murmurs. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's kind of talk about a second wave starting to hit Europe. So that's going to have an impact on sentiment on certain areas of the market. And obviously, now that we have central banks all in fiscal policy, seeming like maybe there'll be more, possibly, but yet at what level from where we were? And if it didn't work to get us where we needed to be with the $1 trillion of money that was put in, you know, what is it going to take? That's the big question. So let's hope it doesn't get to that for more places. But again, the idea of this can be pouring a little bit of cold water on some areas of the markets. And I think we have to respect, again, whether we agree with it or not, whether we think it's political or not, I don't really care. That doesn't matter. We're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about how it impacts the markets. So I want you to keep your eye on that and keep your eye on these sectors. It's a really good idea, I think, at all times to having your watch list, having your kind of daily look at what sectors are moving on a daily and weekly and monthly basis. What kind of rotation is happening? So one of the things you can look for is a relative rotation graph, relative rotation chart, like Bloomberg has it, a few others have it. Go look for that and keep an eye on how it's shifting over time. All right, so you know we talk about fundamentals a lot, right? On the show, we talked about what's going on with the economy, and we talk about economics, but you also know that we take some time to talk about technicals and charts and tools and techniques and indicators. And I wanted to bring on today a master trader. I don't use that term lightly. A master trader to kind of go over just that. I'm pretty excited about this. So how about we get right into that discussion? And our guest today is Linda Raschke. And let me tell you a little bit about Linda, because she has an incredible depth of knowledge. She began her professional trading career in 1981, making markets and options as a member of two exchanges. She became a registered CTA, which is a commodity trading advisor, in 92. And since then, she's been the principal trader for several hedge funds, started her own hedge fund, and actually one of them ranked 17th out of 4,500 for the top best five-year performance by Barclays Hedge. And really, we're going to get into the whole world of technical analysis. So Linda, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So I kind of wanted to start with some very basics, because I saw some of your setup in a variety of different pictures out there, and you do a lot of trading of various different markets. But I thought we'd start very simply with, how do you start your day?
Well, the truth of the matter is my day actually starts the night before, because that's when I do my preparation of my game plan and my homework, so that I'm not influenced by the overnight action or coming in the morning. So that's really important to me. So then when I do actually start my day, I already have my preparation for the day. If I'm going to look for a bias or the markets that I'm going to concentrate on, I'm usually at my desk at 7:15 in the morning. Now that is Central time. So in Florida time, that would be 8:15,
yep.
Because I kind of delineate that as the old institutional time frame for New York. And you'll notice I trade a lot of gold and currencies and bonds, and there is often a very significant inflection point right at that time. So that is the start of our U.S. session officially for me. And then it's just, you know, see what falls into your lap, how the plays unfold.
So talking about that, with regard to some of that, you do this research and you come up with, you know, kind of your own view of where things are going to be. Obviously, anything could change, especially these days with all the news flow that happens. But what is your main go-to process for looking for setups on a security?
I am always looking at levels. That's first and foremost, you know, support, resistance levels, where would be a breakout level, or where do I want to trade against, you know, so and where can the market go? Are there gaps that could be filled, you know, these types of things. So it always starts off with levels, and then you put overlay that with just your classic technical analysis of, is there a degree of trendiness? Is the market channeling, or is it starting to contract after a big move, you know, and then you're in a consolidation mode, because each will dictate a different type of trading style. And so that's, you know, categorize what the mode is or the regime is, you know, trending or consolidating, and where are the levels, and, you know, what is your bias? So for example, in an up channeling market, your bias is going to be to trade from a long side, and that opportunity is all going to come in the first hour. So, you know, that would set the tone for a pretty basic plan there.
So it's interesting, because lately we've had this 9:30 bell Pavlovian response to that, where it's like, no matter what is going on overnight in the futures and all, everybody's like, and not every time, but been this incredible buy, right? Right off that 9:30 bell. And then it kind of goes sideways for a little while. It comes down at the 10 or 11. Then you get another sweep up towards 12, and then kind of sideways for a couple of hours, and then something into the close. That hasn't always been the case that way, has it?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, Andrew, that you do have certain time of day functions, okay? For example, for my time of day functions, you've got the 7 a.m. reading, This is, I'll just use Chicago time to be consistent here, 8:30 NYSE open, 9 o'clock, the first half hour, you either get a morning check mark or you get your continuation there. The sweet spot in the morning trend tends to be that 9 to 10, okay, or 11 to 12, you know, depending on which time zone you're in. And then we get the push into Europe close, which is 10:30. And then noon time is very misleading if you think that nothing happens between 11 to 1 central time. You're either going to have a day filled with great little counter trading scalps when the volume is light, or paradoxically, you'd be surprised at how many trends can unfold in that time frame, just as they did today. Now, in the afternoon session, you have that second hour before the close, that 1 to 2 o'clock time frame is the trendiest time of the day. And once again, you could have bought it, you know, 1 o'clock is central time, sold at 2 o'clock on the bell and had a nice positive expectation. And it tends to be about six basic patterns, okay? This is along the lines, I know you're a market profile type of person, so you're very familiar with the types of days laid out in Jim Dalton's work, Mind Over Markets, where we could see a open test reject, we could see an open trend, you know, and is it going to be a double distribution type of day? We could see open and rotate around the opening price. So you'd still have these six type of time of days as well as delineated by these time of day functions. And that's something that I have found has not changed for 35 years.
Yeah, that was a big question. I mean, like, what's different, right? I mean, we're still dealing with what? Market psychology, individual psychology. We're dealing with, you know, time of day. We're dealing with the opportunity that people want to obviously make money and all that. But I mean, there's been a lot of things that have changed over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, from the days when we were dealing with quarter spreads, right? Those great old days where you had market makers that were individuals. Now you have machines doing it, to the technology. So what do you think has been the biggest change? And I guess you're saying what the things that haven't changed is basically some of the functions of the markets themselves. So what's some of the biggest changes that you've really been dealing with over the last number of years?
I think that, you know, in terms of pure classic technical analysis, you know, momentum functions, trend, all that stuff, it's the same today as it was 100 years ago. And, you know, the volume, you know, the periods of light volume versus heavier volume, it's all the same. But what has changed is because of the broad bandwidth and the, you know, more knowledge in the market participants and so forth, is that you have greater extremes between the noisy periods, and you have a greater extreme in the market efficiency when it breaks out. So, for example, let's say it was 30 years ago, and the market had a trend day, and it was breakout, you know, one of those proverbial, the horse left the barn.
Yeah.
Right. Along the way, you would have a series of maybe 8 to 10 continuation patterns. Did not matter if it was a stock or the S&P futures, you know, but you would have a series of little check marks along the way. And those days are long gone. Now it's a very efficient process, and you can see it with the urgency off the opening price. The first hour's range is about 65% of the day's range, whereas, you know, 30 years ago, the first hour's range was about 45% of the day's range. So that's why, if you remember over the last couple of years, you would just have this open, the first big 5-minute bar, the momentum player and the stocks are all over these things. Of course, they've got them pegged pre-market because you can see how they're trading pre-market and where the gaps are going to be. And pretty much 80% of the move is over at the top of the first 30 minutes. Maybe you get an extension into Europe close, and then the party's over and you're just going to rotate around up there. So that alternation between that extreme efficiency of the move, as Perry Kaufman would call it, versus this ginormous increase in noise, I think is probably the most pronounced difference in the markets today. And that noise is specifically designed to trip newer traders and investors up.
So you, I know this just reminded me of something. I think that a number of years ago, there's a gent who I haven't talked to in a while, actually, Corey Rosenbloom. You may know him. He's a trader, and he would bring up your name, and he would talk about the ATR, the average true range. Wasn't that something that you, or isn't that something that you are fond of?
Average true range was an indicator that was invented or put out there by Wells Wilder in a book that he wrote many years ago that brought to light, you know, parabolic volatility stop and reverse systems, ATR functions, and so forth. Now, the ADX is, I don't look at it anymore. You really don't need to. So it's a really piece of redundant information, and it has a tremendous amount of lag to it. So it's not going to be of much use in a quantitative type of model. Okay. Mm-hmm. It just has way too much lag. And, I think that the most valuable thing for an ADX would be to train, you'll get this, to train a person's eye on the charts for when that ADX is really low, because that indicator is measuring the bar's highs relative to the highs and the bar's lows relative to the lows. And it's going to draw your eye to the fact that there was an unusual amount of price bar overlap. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a low ADX, you can draw a horizontal line through the charts. Now, in your market profile terms, you have defined a point of control, yep, or an equilibrium point or a high volume node. And so you start to see this game of technical analysis can become one merely of semantics, defining things that were defined, you know, hundreds of years ago. Charles Dow, sideways line. So, yeah, there you go.
So it's interesting. There's so many indicators out there, right? I mean, I'm a big fan of utilizing an indicator that gives me what I think is a footprint in what traders are doing. And that is determined by volume based and where they're placing their bets and all that. You know, I want to ask you something. I'm trying to think of what it is now, and I can't remember the indicator name. I don't know where my head is at. But on CNBC, about a bunch of these guys are always talking about, you know, you have a, what is it? What is the indicator they always talk about? You know, it's like...
I don't know. I don't watch CNBC.
I forgot what it is. These guys are always talking about this particular indicator. It's always over 70. It's overbought. It's oversold. The relative strength.
Like
the relative strength. Yeah, the RSI. And
I've always
looked at the RSI. I'm thinking, I don't really understand. I tried to drill down into the RSI. I'm like, I why is everybody using this? It makes no sense.
Well, it's not... You have to look at it this way. It's one component that could be an equation that could be used as a trigger for entry in a trending market. So Larry Connors obviously popularized this. If you have a, I don't know, what is it, a 2 or 3 period RSI and it drops below, you know, 10 or something in a trending market, it's giving a buy signal. You might as well just say that you just had a high to low bar. Okay. But it's, if you're running a scan on a database of 2000 stocks, then it has value in narrowing down your database to the stocks that meet that particular criteria. And then you can dive down from there and perhaps wrap a little bit more context around it.
Right.
So,
but it's not. But what's interesting to note is, and I think what you're saying is that it's really not a standalone. And I say this.
No indicator's a standalone.
Right. That's the point I was making there. You know, that people that are trading a lot of times they get hooked on a particular oscillator or trending or something, like, you know, whatever it may be, and they think that, wow, this look at it, it moved past there and that stock really went up, and they get kind of hooked on that. But really, it's a, as I see it, and I'm asking you, it's I like to look for multiple confirmations out there.
You know, what's so great about this business, Andrew, is that everybody arrives down to their own way of looking at things and what I like to call it their own playing board. You're developing your own game board. And in that process, you know, it's kind of like trying on different hats. And in that process of trying on different hats, you learn something from every little piece of information you look at. For example, you know, if you're looking at market profile or you're looking at a directional indicator such as a momentum oscillator, you know, or, you know, Keltner channels or Bollinger bands or volatility indicators. And so I find that most people in this business go through a process of investigating a lot of things and adding and adding and adding. And then they go through the reverse process as they become more experienced. And your eye now has developed a more critical eye for the charts, because a purist would say that you should be able to see anything with an indicator in the bar charts by itself without that indicator. But that takes a lot of time and experience to get to there. So then as you reach that peak in your you know, exposure to all these things out there, you start to simplify again. It's like, no, I don't need a stochastic and an MACD and an RSI. I'll be fine just with this little momentum indicator.
Right.
You know,
that one works.
I don't need five moving averages.
Right.
Just throw one of them up there, you know, because none of them have any statistical significance. That's what you have to understand, is that they're all tools for helping you see your eye or perhaps smooth the noise. But you are not going to get a positive expectation from any system out there inputting a bunch of these things into TradeStation and coming up with a system that says buy here, sell here. You know, it just it doesn't work that way. And if there was such a thing, it would, the edge would quickly be arbed out, you know, by all the quant shops.
Of course, of course.
So most of the things that are used for the development of strategies like that, and that's why TradeStation adopted the terminology of strategy instead of a system, is, you know, they tend to be either ATR-based, range-based functions, or standard deviation-based functions.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to talk about your book, Trading Sardines, in a second here, but I want to ask you this. I get a lot of questions from new traders often, right? And it comes, you know, whether it's from emails or Twitter or whatever, and it seems to me, I don't know, maybe this is not, I didn't do any kind of real statistical analysis on this, but it seems like the newer trader that you are, the shorter time frames that you want to seemingly use to trade. And I found that people ask me about, like, you know, 1 minute charts or tick. Do you ever use tick charts? I mean, I don't know. I've never really found the use of that. I thought that you can.
Tick charts are my favorite.
Oh, well, there you go.
I love, like, for the S&Ps, I use a 4,000 tick chart and a 20,000 tick chart. So it's kind of like a 5 minute and a 15 minute, because it condenses the overnight action perfectly. So I wouldn't use a one tick chart, but, you know.
Right. As I'm saying, some people use really short term charts. And I said, how do you even figure out what's going on with that? I mean, I have no problem with a longer term, whether it's, you know, but even on a minute chart.
You have to start somewhere. And I think that what they'll find is they find something that works, or, you know, everybody has to do their own process. And the problem with, like, 1 minute charts is that the data is just way too noisy. You'll quickly get chopped up.
Right.
And I don't know, at least at my ripe old age, I would not have the intensity or focus to watch 1 minute data. But it doesn't mean that you can't be following, say, a 15 minute chart intraday, and you go down to a 1 or 2 minute time frame and you see that little buy or sell divergence at the bottom of a swing, and it works like a charm.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Best reward.
The thing is that, like, for example, when we use Market Profile, and that is a combination very basically of price action with volume. So the problem, though, is when you have very short term time frames, like the 1 minute that you're talking about, there's not enough push of information, that volume information, to give us any kind of reading on a 1 minute chart utilizing a Market Profile. I mean,
that's because you're using volume. I'm talking about, right, you don't have to use volume. I don't use volume in my trading. I haven't used volume for 40 years, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't have value and you can't use it. It's
I get it. I'm just saying that from what we do with volume, it just, that part of it doesn't make sense. Talk about the latest book you have, Trading Sardines, and you can get this over on your website, which is,
oh, golly, lindarashke.net. That's a mouthful, huh?
Yeah. we'll put that on the show notes for this episode, episode number 680, because it's spelled R-A-S.
680? You guys have done 680 episodes?
Since 2007. We're one of the OGs of this.
Wow, I'm impressed.
Thanks. So it's Raschke, R-A-S-C-H-K-E, which we'll get that to you. So tell me about this book and what why you wanted to write this and a little bit about it.
I have had six books outlined for 20 years, you know, on all different kinds of stuff. Technical analysis, trading sardines, just popped out. It wasn't even on the original outline, you know. And it's really hard for me to write, you know. It took me a long, long time to kind of pull this thing off, but it kind of came down to the fact that it's a book about outliers and all the crap that happened to me and all the trades that I was on the wrong side of just from random events, and that this is the business. It's understanding risk. And I mean, I got bludgeoned with some like crazy rude outlier events, you know, from having on exactly the wrong position that you would want to have on when that plane flew into the World Trade Center. I was short euro dollars. That was my biggest position. Well, you know what happened to that market after they reopened it after 5 days, right? You know, I was long the grains when Chernobyl happened. Well, you know what happened to those? They all got crashed down, you know, and it's just like case after case after case of this random stuff like that. And, you know, the infrastructure and our software and all the things in the business that people don't consider. So it's in part, you know, kind of tongue in cheek that my trading career was not made of these glorious wins or home runs. You know, it really was a long, long, you know, immersion in a lifestyle. And that's what this business is about. So it's truly this immersion into this lifestyle. And the great thing is there's so many wonderful people in this industry and characters. So I could weave in some of the people that I learned the greatest lessons from who are no longer with us now. And I thought that, you know, all their pearly words of wisdom. Every chapter has like main lessons that I learned that I would think that would be the most important lessons for a trader going forward. And it's all humor, you know, because that's my greatest weapon against stress in this business is humor. God knows you have to have a sense of humor. So, I mean, it was like, you know, the books all the way through the end, it's like I had all my money and my hedge fund in MF Global, you know, when that got like shut down. And it's like, you know, all the crazy stuff that happens in this business.
Right.
Wow.
So it's interesting because that's a good segue into the idea of, listen, anything can happen anytime, but what kind of levels of stops? So here's the thing. So I think what you're also saying is that, you know, you didn't build your career on necessarily one big trade. You know, you had a succession of losers and winners, but over time, the winners outpaced the losers, obviously, because you're still here with us, or you're just, you know, just finding this all very funny to begin with, but I don't think that's the case, right? You know, so what do you use for risk management?
I use risk management. I am a bottom line person, so I'm always watching the bottom line on my portfolio. It's not like there's always risk on one individual position per se. And, you know, usually with my size, and in particular the size of the fund, you're not putting in stops in the marketplace because you just don't have the luxury of the liquidity to do that. So, but you do have levels where you know that you're wrong, you know, and you do have levels where you an idea as to how the trade should progress if it's working, even if it's just on a 5-minute chart, you know, or if it's on a monthly chart, you know how you are, you should be looking for that to unfold. So, of course, you want to have some idea of initial stop or initial risk. And if the thing is not working, if your trade is not working, the number one rule is get smaller. So I'm pretty good about that. If something's starting to give me question or pause, even if it's just going sideways and not doing anything, I just might start reducing the size. And then the real trick is, this is the real trick of money management in my book, is that when something starts to work and you have been stocking and waiting for it, and you start to see your proverbial volume come in or activity or interest, you know, you need to be very quick to add. And that's where the real money is made, you know, is loading the boat on those ones that you just know that you got the tiger for the tail. And unfortunately, those times are far and few between, you know, but that's also a big part of money management. The majority of your time, trade on a very small line, you know, trade on the, yeah, trade on small size. And you know who wrote a wonderful book? James Grant, you know, on risk. And in the latter half of that book, he did risk control for Stevie Cohen, I think, Tudor Jones, a whole bunch of people. But it's not hard and dry, you know, math stuff like you might think. There's a lot of warmth and psychology. And especially in the end, he talks about the importance of maintaining a certain degree of trading activity, because every time you go into the marketplace and make a trade, it is then giving you back information. And he thought that was a really important part of the process.
Well, that makes sense. So, you're talking about Jim Grant with the bow tie? Or is it somebody different?
Is it Kenneth Grant?
Yeah, I don't know if it's Jim Grant, because Jim Grant's more a treasury guy and a more of a bond guy, and Jim Grant's Almanac, I think he has.
No. Let me see here. Trading Risk is the name of the book, and his name is Kenneth Grant.
Kenneth Grant. Okay, good. Yes. I'm glad we squared that. So, you know, you do a lot of education. I think you and your husband have a trading room. You do a whole bunch of coaching, I suppose is the right word to use. What is it?
I don't do any coaching, and I do very minimal education.
You have a trading room, don't you?
We have this trading room because it's for the first, and we only started it a couple months ago, but you have to understand, my husband's been in the markets for 42 years as well, and he was actually a broker in the S&P pit for many years. He did execution for Lewis Bacon, Tudor Jones, the RightX funds, all kinds of people, and then he ran his technology firm. And so we were both sort of retiring. And the truth of the matter is, he always wanted to get back into trading more. And because it's hard to do when you're running a technology company.
Sure.
So we started this up, and it's really fun because during the day, you know, we're both trading, and we have a core group in there. We haven't really marketed or advertised it or anything, but he'll call trades on crude and gold and the S&Ps, and I do my markets, you know, my funky markets. And so it's just, it's like being on the trading floor, you know, there's a steady banter, it's
right.
The camaraderie, the jokes, you know, we've got four Zoom screens at any time you can toggle between and see different stuff. And it just, it's a way of staying engaged, you know. It's got to be a challenge for people just out of their own home without any companionship. And I am just a firm believer in not having that television on. I think it does more harm than good. So,
yeah, I hear you. So, I mean, but you've been around enough to know, I guess the thing when I start bringing up the whole idea of what are your sell stops, and I talk about, you know, what are the trade rules that you have, as well as, you know, what kind of charts do you use and what is good for maybe some of the things we talked about with new investors. What are kind of the, do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that new traders, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of new traders out there right now, right? A lot. So what
You know, I can tell you the things that hold people back. And the first is underestimating how long it takes. Okay. So, you know, there's really a long, long learning curve, at least 3 years, because you have to see bull markets, you have to see bear markets, you have to see quiet dead markets, you have to see aberrations and volatility. And so it's like a radiologist doing an internship. You're not going to spend 2 months of looking at x-rays and MRIs and, you know, CAT scans and have gotten it. You know, there's so many subtle nuances. So I think people really underestimate how long it takes to achieve some type of consistency. And they also need to understand that part of their journey is trying out different styles. They may not be suited to be a day trader. Heck, they might want to just do seasonals in the grains. You know, there's so many different styles out there. And in that process of those trying on hats again, you have to give something 2 or 3 months to try this style, 2 or 3 months to try market profile, 2 or 3 months to see if options trading works for you. And that's all part of this initial journey. So it takes a lot longer than people think. The second thing is that people are grossly undercapitalized more often than not. And it's like trying to sit down at a poker player, you know, at a poker table with five other top, you know, master poker players, and you think you're going to be able to play a game when you have like a hundredth of the money that they do.
Right.
No, because it's going to influence your decision-making process, you know? And I don't think people fully understand that the mental and psychological part of the game is about 90% of the equation. It's not about the indicators and these kitschy little, you know, things that you can look at. It's about yourself and the money and, you know, are you following a consistent program? And do you have, and then thirdly, the confidence. You know, people are either overly confident, incorrectly so, but they haven't built up that confidence that really comes from doing your own analysis, your own testing, your own modeling, your own research, taking something. You know, you offer a lot of tools for people. They need to take your tools and then work with them, make them their own, maybe add their own little twist. Is there a different time of day function? How does it look on this market? What does it look like when it works? And what does it look like when it doesn't work? So that's taking, you know, a tool that you might offer and then them making it their own. And that's a big part of the process.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, words of wisdom for someone who is not just in the market for the last week, but obviously in for, well, decades. And I appreciate Linda Raschke coming on board today. Thank you so much. Well, a wealth of knowledge. I'm going to have you again. I'll put all the information on where you can get Trading Sardines and also find more information about Linda over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes for this episode. So thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Andrew. You too.
Okay, thanks. And that's a wrap for this show of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Like I said, don't forget, now available on Amazon Music. You can grab the episodes there as well as iTunes and Spotify and just all over. So thanks for joining me. Stick around for all the things we have coming up this week. DH Unplugged, the Monday pop-up Q&A webinars, of course. All the information's over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. By the way, we put up, I think last week or the week before, we put up that brand new virtual tour of the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. Just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and go to, scroll down a bit, work with us, and then you could find it through there. Check out the virtual tour. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.